Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Hospitals around the country are now required by federal law to post their prices, from the cost to set a bone to the charge for a couple of aspirin. The idea is to give consumers a fighting chance in planning their health care, but hospital managers have warned that the process is more complicated. Steve Wagner is executive director for Universal Healthcare Action Network in Ohio, and he joins us. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And by phone, the Ohio Health System Vice President of Revenue Cycle, Margaret Schuller. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
That's an interesting title, Vice President of Revenue Cycle. But that goes to exactly to what we're talking about today, right?
It does.
What you charge. Why is pricing complicated?
Why is pricing complicated? Well, first of all, we're supportive on pricing transparency. Mm-hmm. And we have taken a position of really being a patient advocate through this complicated process. And so the requirement that was required of all health systems, hospital systems, January 1st this year, we were asked to publish our list prices, if you will, on our website. We have posted a price hotline because it is complicated, and it's complicated because everyone's benefits are different. Your out-of-pocket, your actual out-of-pocket expense is going to be different based off, do you have insurance, do you not have insurance, the employer you work for, the type of premium you pay, where you are in your deductible cycle, where you are in your out-of-pocket maximums. Again, how that benefit plan is set up individually for you. So it's a case-by-case discussion with our consumers and our patients. So it's very important for our consumers and our patients to really understand it is complicated, but we're here to help.
Does it vary, like within the Ohio health system, does it vary? Possibly just take the same consumer. Would it vary between hospitals?
We have a couple hospitals in our outlying areas that slightly different prices. Doesn't necessarily mean your out-of-pocket would be completely different. So, again, it's a case-by-case discussion with the consumer and the patient.
Steve Wagner, what are your thoughts about what you're seeing hospitals posting and these things like the price hotline from Ohio Health?
Yeah, I think first to the price hotline, that's fantastic. I've seen that.
Not required by law, by the way, right?
Right. But I've seen that with all of the hospital sites that I've gone to have offered that kind of price hotline because, as was said, it is complicated, both hospital visits are complicated and what you're going to get there when you show up, as well as the cost of those services and products that you get. So it's great to have this hotline to help explain not only what it is that the hospital's charging, but what you're going to have to pay out of pocket.
Mm-hmm. So I call on this hotline, Margaret Schuller, and I tell them what?
What you tell them is, first of all, if you're a shopper, and you are looking for, you're shopping across, let's say, Central Ohio for services, you can call this hotline, tell us what your insurance is, and then the particular service you're shopping for, you're looking into, CAT scan, MRI, MAMO, et cetera. And then based off your insurance, we will be able to tell you, and we have systems that help us do this, where you are with your deductible and your copays, and we'll be able to give you an estimate on what your out-of-pocket expense is actually going to be.
And that would be just for Ohio Health. I'd have to call the OSU Wexner Medical Center if I want to know what they charge.
Correct. It's only for Ohio Health providers.
Now, let's say, you know, I'll just use a personal experience. I cut my hand. I severed a sensory nerve and an artery in my hand. They were able to tie up the artery, but the sensory nerve, I had to wait until a day after Christmas to get that taken care of. I took the only doctor that I could find that could take me. That's not that I don't have a choice. But are you recommending Steve Wagner that I would shop during that time and see what it would cost and that kind of a thing?
Yeah. So I think there are limits to how useful this is in terms of shopping, because just as you said, our healthcare is oftentimes very personal with the physician we have, or sometimes with the physician that's covered in our insurance. And so you're driven in particular ways, and you can't necessarily just find the cheapest around there. I think another thing to know about this is physicians' costs are not included as part of this. So your hospital visit is about the services that the hospital provide, but for example, an anesthesiologist wouldn't be listed.
The anesthesia I'd be charged for, but wouldn't know what the anesthesiologist. How is that helpful? That's usually the biggest expense, isn't it? The physicians?
It depends. Well, of course, it all depends on what you're doing. But okay. Yeah, it can be a large cost. But, you know, your operating room, if you have to have surgery, your other supplies, your stay itself and the bed stay can be a significant portion of your cost as well.
Margaret Schuller, are you convinced or confident that people understand the limitations of this?
I'm not sure everyone understands the limitations. That's why this is an excellent opportunity for us to come on air and try to inform, again, our patients and our consumers in the community, because it is so complicated. And again, we're trying to share that price hotline for patients to get additional information because it is not straightforward. The other tip I'd like to give folks listening this morning is to call your insurance company. They also have a wealth of knowledge on pricing and, again, what services are covered, not covered, what requires an authorization, et cetera. So it's very important for consumers, not only as they're engaging in figuring out their next steps for their health care, is to work with their insurance companies and also work with their providers.
Okay. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about this new federal law that requires hospitals to post their costs. But as my guest, Steve Wagner of the Universal Healthcare Action Network in Ohio pointed out, doesn't include the cost for the physicians. Also with us, Margaret Schuller. She's System Vice President of Revenue Cycle at Ohio Health. Again, questions or comments, 614-292-8513. And Michael in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. I have a question. Basically, why does the insurance matter in the cost of the service being provided? You know, if I'm calling around to get a price for a CAT scan, why does my insurance matter? I understand that it matters in maybe in the cost that I will end up paying, but does the hospital or the provider vary the cost of the service based on if you have good insurance or bad insurance or no insurance
or Medicaid or nothing? Right. Margaret Schuller.
Sure, it's a terrific question, and it does vary, and that insurance coverage is very important. So here, every employer, for example, has a negotiated benefit plan with an insurance company, whether it's Aetna, UHC, MMO, if they're self-insured, et cetera. And so, again, the benefit plan with that particular insurance company is very unique. It's case by case. And that's why having the insurance information during the price estimate discussion is so important. The other piece is hospitals. Contract with the insurance payers as well. And there are different rate structures with each insurance payer. Again, that makes the patients or the consumers out of pocket slightly different, depending on what insurance company they get their benefits through. Also, it depends on the individual member or, again, the patient and consumer on the type of premium that they pay, because the higher the premium, many times there are more covered services. Many times the lower the premium or the higher deductible, there are less covered items and more out of pocket.
But so, the bottom again, line of what that item might cost doesn't necessarily change. Right, Steve Wagner?
Yeah, well, and I think part of this is language is important. So the cost of what it takes to provide, factoring in administrative or all the things mm-hmm. that the hospital has to do, is a particular number. But what they're going to charge is based on agreements they've made with different insurance providers or
and
others.
That's and the individuality part of it. Doug in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Mike. Yeah, I think I have the same question to the Ohio Health Representative, that on contracts that are based on a percentage of charge, what she's referring to is patient responsibility. And I think the federal law addresses hospital pricing in that when you have a contract that maybe pays you 100% or 105% of Medicare or something, you can effectively give yourself a raise by raising your prices. And perhaps the patient responsibility doesn't go up very much and the individual patient responsibility is complicated. But the price that is being charged is where the law is talking. Is how much are you actually, is it costing you for each of these services? So I'm not sure why we're conflating the issues. The price of the service should remain the same, I would assume, no matter where the patient's insurance lies.
So the price of the insurance or the price of the service should remain the same no matter where the insurance lies. Margaret Schuller?
So the price, the list price, is the same. There are, without going into too many details, we can't just give ourselves a pay increase. Medicare, for example, has a lot of fixed reimbursement. So even if you increase your charges, Medicare is going to just give you the flat amount. So there are checks and balances in the process there. So the list price, though, is what is out on the website. And again, the individual, the gentleman is correct, on the out-of-pocket is very different. But the list price is the same for everybody.
I think there's kind of also a piece worth mentioning. It is worth seeing these charges that are for different procedures, because whether or not you pay that full price when you get your bill, you've paid that somewhere, right? This isn't magic money that comes mm-hmm. from insurers. It's your premiums that are going to pay these charges from the hospital. Mm-hmm.
So it gives people a better understanding overall of what things cost.
Right.
Doug, thanks for that call. Let's see, Anna in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Anna.
Hey, hi. Thanks for taking the call. Really quick, I in December took a relative to a scheduled doctor's appointment. At the appointment, they asked for x-rays and blood work. When we tried to find out, and the x-rays and blood work were in the same facility, when we tried to find out what the cost of the blood work and the x-rays were, we stood there, we called the insurance company, we asked them for diagnosis codes and any codes that would assist in the insurance company. It was impossible to get. Finally, someone who worked in the back office came forward and said, look, I don't have a way of telling you the cost because of all these things. It depends on your employer, it depends on your insurer, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. But I can give you, you know, I can tell you to make the patient feel better that it'll probably be around $200 your cost. Now, we haven't seen what the bills are, but it's frustrating to go into a doctor's. I mean, this whole process should be so much more transparent and easy. Just a comment. I'll listen for your response.
Yeah, thanks. Anna, thanks for the call. It's good point, Steve Wagner.
Yeah, I think that is where these hotlines that the hospitals are offering are fantastic. There's actually a hospital in town that has an online form that you can submit that with your insurer, and they'll pull that up within 2 days, they say. I also think the x-ray was an interesting example because I pulled some of the figures. And there's a lot of variability between just even getting an x-ray between. So, you know, there's a facility for a x-ray of your foot with two views. One hospital will charge $178. Another hospital charges $341. Somebody's paying that amount mm-hmm. on average. Mm-hmm. You might pay the same whether you went to one or the other hospital, but somehow or another, that's what's being charged, and it's very different.
So, and Margaret Schuller, is someone like Anna exactly who you're trying to, is respond to with the hotline?
It is, and I really appreciate Anna's comments because That is a frustration from our consumers, and we're trying to make it easier. And using the hotline, we can have that individual discussion, especially folks that have elective procedures and want to make a very, very informed decision. That's why we have the hotline available.
And this has the potential. So, Pomeranian Hospital in Millersburg, Ohio, because they serve a significant Amish community that wants to pay in cash and wants to know exactly how much that is, they've actually gone to some bundled pricing. So you know from the very beginning what it is you're going to pay if you're paying in cash for a delivery, child delivery, or other kinds of procedures.
Well, I look forward to catching up on this as it moves forward to see how much it's helped people out there. For the time being, Margaret Schuller, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Margaret Schuller is Assistant Vice President of Revenue Cycle at Ohio Health, and Steve Wagner is the Executive Director for Universal Healthcare Action Network in Ohio. Thanks again, Steve, for all your help.
Thank you.
More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Maybe you've heard of Dry January, the idea of swearing off alcoholic beverages in the first month of the year. Well, vegans have their own pledge. Veganuary is the online charity intended to inspire veganism year-round by asking people to pledge to go vegan, that is, eliminate all animal products from their diets, for the month of January. A record number of people have already signed up for that. We're talking about the challenges now. Joining us is Professor of Nutrition and Epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health, Dr. Walter Willett. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
Vegan means no animal. What are the benefits? What do we know about why this is a good thing?
There are some benefits, at least potentially, and that's because high consumption of many animal products, especially red meat and processed red meat, are related to many risks, including overweight, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and total mortality. So cutting down on these foods potentially can have some important health benefits directly. But one really important point here is if you're thinking of going vegan, it's a healthy vegan diet is much more than giving up animal products. It's about replacing those animal products with healthy plant sources of protein. If we just replace those animal products with a lot of refined starch and sugar, things might be the same or even worse. Mm-hmm. Also, do keep in mind that if someone is going on a strict vegan diet, eventually our body stores of vitamin B12 will run out, and that means that we're likely to get severe neurologic complications, very important for growing children, but also for adults. So if someone is going to be on a vegan diet for more than a few months, it's really essential to either take a supplement, and a multiple vitamin will do, that contains vitamin B12, or take food products that are fortified with vitamin B12. So there are a few caveats here, but in general, moving toward a more plant-based diet, even if it's not a strictly absolute vegan diet, can have major health benefits. And I would add, and we might want to circle back to it, really important health benefits for our planet and the world our children will inherit.
Yeah. I hear about people getting B12 shots. Is that what you're talking about?
We don't need shots, no. That a standard multiple vitamin, and check the label to be sure, but the vast majority contain many times the RDA for vitamin B12, and that will work unless someone actually can't absorb B12 and has pernicious anemia. There are a few people that may need B12 shots, but the vast majority of people who don't have pernicious anemia can do just fine with a multiple vitamin.
I hear about people who give up mostly meat. They're vegetarians, but also vegans that have problems as they age with muscle loss.
There are issues of getting enough protein as we age and start to go downhill, what we call that frailty. And it may be that that's a point in life where some extra protein can be helpful there, although by far and away the most important thing to do if we're approaching that period is to do resistance training to keep our muscles in shape. It's possible that adding a little extra protein, but it doesn't necessarily need to be animal protein, can help help us maintain the muscle mass. But resistance training and staying fit is by far the most important factor. Mm.
You've said that a third of all premature deaths could be prevented if people stopped eating meat and that a vegan diet could be even more beneficial. What's the connection between longevity and what we eat?
Well, let's see. That's a third of our deaths could be prevented by going toward a more plant-based diet and, again, adopting an overall healthy eating pattern. Poor diets, for many reasons, including excessive amounts of animal protein, and especially red meat, are related to higher risks of many disease outcomes. So I already mentioned type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease. It looks like chronic lung disease, other conditions as well, would be improved by shifting toward a more plant-based diet.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the vegan diet today. My guest is Dr. Walter Willett. He's a professor of nutrition and epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. If you have a question about vegan diet, veganism, if you're one of the people that made the pledge to go vegan for January to check it out, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Willett, what do you think about people making something like a one-month pledge when it comes to something like veganism?
I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with it, but a lot of times adopting something that's sort of the extreme end of the spectrum can make it can be unsustainable for people. And that doesn't do us too much good unless we find a way of eating that can really, that we can stick with in the long run. And there again, I would make the point that, well, I like to look at this as a spectrum of diets. On one end, we have the paleo meat diet, which is almost all animal protein. And the other end, we have being a vegan. And there's a lot in between there. Shifting, the evidence is very clear based on what happens to our blood cholesterol fractions or our long-term epidemiologic studies looking at mortality and major disease outcomes. The overall evidence says we're going to be much better off toward that more plant-based end of the spectrum. But we don't really have evidence that it's better off to be a strict vegan than it is to be what we might call a flexitarian or a primarily plant-based diet, say like the traditional Mediterranean diet. And having a little flexibility in there makes it a lot easier for many people to eat a primarily plant-based diet. I'm not a vegan myself, but I would say that probably two-thirds of my meals are vegan meals. I like and enjoy that flexibility. And it does, having a little variety, more variety in there, having a little modest amount of dairy, some fish, for example, can give us a little bit more of a safety net in terms of not having some nutritional gaps in our diet. Again, if somebody wants to be a vegan, strict vegan, that's fine, but we can have almost all or maybe all or even maybe a little bit more benefits by something that's close to a vegan diet, but not absolute.
Where do you see, what about replacing calcium? Is that an issue as well, or is protein the main problem?
Well, calcium is an essential element in our diet. We need to have enough, but almost for sure the amount of calcium that we need has been overstated because the studies that set the RDAs are very short-term, based on just 2 or 3 weeks, and that can be, and almost for sure, is very misleading. For example, the U.S. Recommendations, RDAs for people over 50 for calcium is 1,200 milligrams a day, but the U.K. has looked at all the evidence and said we only need 700 milligrams a day, and one can get that with a decent diet plus one serving of dairy a day. If someone's having zero dairy a day, you can get enough calcium from plant-based sources, but if you're concerned, take another 500 milligrams by as a supplement. That's a very easy thing to do. I grew up in Michigan in a dairy family for generations, so I'm definitely sympathetic with dairy, but we don't need the vast amounts that are being recommended.
Dan in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi. What I've been hearing about the processed, you know, meats and stuff that are on the market, how they're causing problems, but I'm not hearing the alternative, which is the heavily processed vegan options that are out there, like Beyond Meat.
Okay, that's a good point. Any thoughts about that, Dr. Willett?
Yes, a good question. And there are, again, the alternatives, what we're going to eat if we don't eat red meat, are hugely important. And the best trade-offs come from consuming foods that are nuts and soybeans and some other legumes, some other bean products as well, because those have positive health benefits. So you get a double win by switching from, say, if you're going to have a bologna sandwich, have a peanut butter sandwich, or if you're going to have a regular meatloaf, have a my wife makes a great nut lentil meatloaf. You get a double win because you're giving up something that has adverse effects and you're adding something that has positive health benefits. So now there are, in the last few years, these sort of factory meat substitutes like Beyond Beef and I guess Impossible Burger and things like that. We don't need those, for sure. We don't need those to have healthy diets. But I do think it's good to have lots of options for people out there, because some people really want something and almost addicted to having something that's like meat in their diet. And some of those alternatives are almost for sure going to be better because at least we know that they don't have some of the adverse things that are in are in meat, but again, some of them are not so great. And I think your caller has a very good point. We need to look critically at what the alternatives are. I would say that many vegan diets are actually not healthy. Vegan does not mean healthy, because it's just talking about what you don't eat. It's not talking about what you do eat as plant alternatives. And a lot of vegan diets may be very high in refined starch and sugar and salt to make up for flavor. A lot of vegan products, if I look at the local Whole Paycheck store here, it's got lots of junk foods that are vegan. And so just being vegan does not mean a healthy diet. You can say that about an omnivore too, that many omnivore diets can be really healthy, but they can also be full of junk food, as we very well know.
You've also done research into the environmental benefits of going vegan, and you wanted to talk about that. How does, you know, veganism, how is it better for the environment?
Yes, and I think given what we see going on our planet today, it's really critical that we think about everything we do in our daily activities and our national policies, as well as our individual choices, through an environmental lens as well, that the environmental changes, especially greenhouse gas and climate change, are happening so quickly now. They're accelerating beyond what we imagined even a couple of decades ago. And unless we make some really big changes, the world we pass on to our children will be devastated, and the societies will be disruptive. It will be a very dark world we pass on to our children. And our food choices make a big difference, that the amount of greenhouse gas production per serving or per gram of protein from beef is about 20 times higher than it is per gram of protein from, say, lentils or from nuts in our diet. So our choices make a huge difference, and having a healthy vegan diet will have much less environmental impact than the average American diet, which today has a large amount of red meat. And dairy is in between. It's not quite as bad as red meat is for environmental impacts, but it's many times higher still than plant-based protein sources.
So people who are motivated by that, where could they go to find out what the impact on the planet is when they eat?
There are, let's see, I should have an exact website to go to now. We do have a report that's coming out. It will be in a major medical journal, Lancet, just next week, in fact, that has that information and a lot of details about the both health and planetary impacts of different sources of protein in the diet. And we'll make the critical point that this is a very big issue. And the good news is that there is a double win path, that we're on a lose-lose path at the moment. Our American diets, the diets around the world for the vast majority of people, are unhealthy. Their health is being undermined. And at the same time, it's destroying our planet. But there is a pathway that is, includes a more sustainable diet that's primarily plant-based, not necessarily totally vegan, although vegan is one of the options. And it also can lead to a sustainable environment as well. So that will have a lot more detail in it. We do have a website on, if you just Google Nutrition Source, that's our department website at Harvard Department of Nutrition, and there's a lot of information there, too, that includes information on the environment.
Okay, well, we will post that website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Dr. Walter Willett, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
Dr. Walter Willett is a professor of nutrition and epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. We'll have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Researchers at the University of Washington are testing a contraceptive gel for men. We're talking about that and other male health issues today. Joining us by phone is Los Angeles-based urologist and author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health, Dr. Dudley Danoff. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you very much.
So male birth control is being tested in Seattle. It's a gel. It has to be applied every day to the arms and shoulders. How does it work?
Well, it works with the hormone progestin, which is a female birth control pill. They also add some testosterone to counter the effect of the progestin. The research is not new. It's been going on for a number of years, and I think it's at least 5 or more years away from being widely used, but it is very, very promising. I mean, the burden has always been on the female for birth control, and this seems to be a very reasonable idea. It decreases sperm production to a level that pregnancy is not possible, with minimal side effects to male libido, which is what we're looking for.
That was kind of the trick of this whole thing, right?
Well, yeah, that's the balance.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that decreases the T or decreases sperm production usually affects libido, which is not desirable for most men.
Reducing the sperm production, is this it has to be done every day,
right?
But therefore it's a temporary fix. You can't go off it and the sperm production will resume.
Well, it takes about 8 to 16 weeks if you stop the drug or the gel. It takes about 8 to 16 weeks for sperm production to return to pre-treatment levels.
Why can't they just take a pill?
Well, we have to figure out what to put in the pill.
Well, you can't put that same thing in a pill?
You know, I think it's a matter of absorption.
Okay.
Selective absorption. So we have these, many of the drugs that we use, including testosterone, you can't take them orally because they're toxic to the liver, but you can put them on the skin and there is a transdermal absorption.
Uh-huh.
So it avoids the toxicity of the oral medication. And I think that's the problem with most of these preparations. They are toxic to the liver.
So are they testing other things, or is this pretty much the big hope?
Well, I've seen over the last 4 or 5 years as I studied the field, there are things like this that are being studied, various combinations of progestin and testosterone. It's still in the very early stages. I do think it's promising, and I do think it's on the horizon. It's just a slow trek through the snow.
Mm-hmm. And just from what you understand and in your years of working with male patients, do you feel comfortable that they're reliable for something like this when it's not their body that gets impregnated?
Well, I think the liability of a drug company who puts out a product and claims it's a contraceptive, mm-hmm. and 24 men get impregnated their partner.
Mm-hmm.
I think the liability is enormous. So just from a medical legal point of view, I don't think anybody would put the product out there unless they had a high degree of certainty that it was effective with minimal side effects.
Let's see, Tom in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Tom.
How you doing?
Good.
Good. So I called immediately. Here's an opening comment: that the protection has always been on the female is preposterous. I don't know why we're trying to come up with all these other solutions except for a condom. I wore a condom every time I had intercourse or any type of sexual contact until I got married. It's not that complicated. All these rubs and creams that mess with testosterone, who knows what additional side effects it's going to have 10 years from now.
Mm.
So the comment that's always been on the woman, it has not. It's always been on a responsible male and a responsible woman to not do that. I don't understand what the problem is.
Mm. Okay. Dr. Danoff?
Well, a couple of things. First, many men, you'll find a condom to be objectionable. I've heard the analogies like taking a shower with your socks on. Most men do use condoms, and they use them responsible. The woman ovulates only one time a month. A man produces nearly 100 million sperm every time he ejaculates. So if we can come up with something that has minimal side effects and reduces sperm production in men, I think it's a big step forward. I'm not denigrating men's responsibility in birth control, but I think if we could get a gel or something which is safe, I mean, it's a huge and giant step forward.
And it's just another option, right?
Just another option.
Okay. Tom, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. There's the issue of male infertility. You talked about how many sperm a typical male produces every time he ejaculates, but that's not the case for everybody. And there was a Time Magazine article recently about what the writer called the silent shame of male infertility. Talk about that and the shame. What's going on there?
Well, this article was about a bodybuilder. So he was juicing or taking exogenous testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
So he had, bulging muscles and a fantastic body and muscle mass and great mood. But what was happening is testicles were shrinking. So if you take exogenous testosterone, i.e. juicing, what happens is the pituitary in the brain just shuts off sperm production. So the testes go to sleep. And the testes literally disintegrate; they involute, and pretty soon, if he's not taking exogenous testosterone, he's absolutely infertile. His sperm count will go to zero, which it did.
And it can't come back, or it can?
Well, it can, but it is very, 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 very difficult. I've seen many, many bodybuilders with the bulging muscles and teeny testes who have taken years and years and years and without testosterone supplements and still do not have a normal sperm count. So it's very, very, very dicey.
And there's a stigma surrounding this. I guess the point is that they're not coming for help soon enough.
Well, a man is a macho creature. I mean, he wants to catch the touchdown in the last quarter of the Super Bowl. He doesn't want to admit any weakness, and he certainly doesn't want to admit that he's infertile. I mean, that is the heart of a man's soul. And yet there are groups, there are websites, there are people that are getting together and trying to talk this out, but men are still very, very, very reluctant to come out of the closet, particularly in terms of infertility.
So this is something it often when fertility issues arise between a couple, the first place they go is the female, right? Or is that starting to change?
Well, it is starting to change, and rightfully so. Mm-hmm. But for millenniums and baby boomers, the case was it was the woman. Mm-hmm. But if a man admits it to his wife or his partner, I mean, that's a big step forward. I think you have to admit that you have a problem before you can solve a problem.
Is the issue that you described about the bodybuilder, is that the typical reason why, or are there other reasons?
Well, that is certainly the most common, is exogenous testosterone. Now, there is a syndrome of low serum testosterone. The levels we usually expect of testosterone are 270 to about 1,000 nanograms per milliliter. So if you have a low serum testosterone and have the symptoms of, you know, the grumpy old man, a little bulge in the middle, loss of muscle mass, loss of energy, and you have a low serum testosterone, it is legitimate to get exogenous testosterone either by injection or by a gel to raise your testosterone to normal levels, but you must be monitored. If you have excessive exogenous testosterone, the testicles will shrink, it will thicken your blood, and you become more prone to a stroke or a heart attack. So exogenous testosterone is not without risk, mm-hmm. but used properly in the proper setting, low testosterone, medical supervision, I mean, it's a great drug.
A urologist at the Weill Cornell Medicine School of Medicine in New York was quoted in that Time article saying that he's noticed a positive shift in how men approach infertility. Are you seeing something of the same?
Yeah, in general, I think, you know, men are being what I would call more feminized, meaning that, I mean, they're not becoming girly, but they're becoming more soulful. They're becoming more aware. They're becoming more of a partner. I see it in child rearing. I see it in my own children, how they raise their children as compared to, you know, my hands-off raising mm-hmm. of my children. Mm-hmm. So I think there's been a monumental shift, a favorable shift.
And you were talking about those symptoms was related to if you're starting to, like, for older men, that is a thing. I mean, low testosterone levels do change as you age, right?
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, the statistics are very clear and very well established. After the age of 40, your testosterone decreases about 3% per year. And after age 60, about 20% of all men have a low serum testosterone, low enough to mandate testosterone replacement therapy. We call that TRT. And again, you cannot take testosterone by mouth, so all these supplements that say they're testosterone that you see over the counter, mm-hmm. they're not really testosterone because testosterone is very, very toxic to the liver. So you have to take it either by injection once every 2 or 3 weeks so you get the hills and the valleys of effectiveness. After the injection, a boost in testosterone towards the end of the cycle down in the valley. So we're using creams and gels, a much more even level, and we get the testosterone just about where we want it, 400 to 500. Safety, effectiveness, and it works.
We're talking about male sexual health today. My guest is Dr. Dudley Danoff. If you have a question or comment about any of this kind of stuff, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Dr. Danoff has become something of a regular on the show, and we appreciate, we appreciate it. It's kind of been it's part of the issue of addressing these kinds of hang-ups.
Issues that we were afraid to talk about.
Exactly.
Years ago. Yeah, that's my rule.
Yeah. A couples therapist and a CNN contributor, Ian Kerner, wrote that he's seeing more young men complaining about low testosterone at his practice. Are you hearing the same?
Well, not only do I hear it, I see it, and this also is affected by energy level and nutrition and genetics. Health conditions, medications, so all of those can contribute to a low testosterone in younger men. We can't call it andropause, because andropause usually refers to men who are over 60, but mm-hmm. it is an andropause, which is male menopause-like syndrome in younger men.
Do they get hot flashes?
Well, no, they don't get hot flashes. But
just checking.
But, yeah. I mean, they have diminished the libido. They have erectile problems. And factors like, you know, obesity, stress, inadequate sleep, all of those things in younger men will contribute to a low testosterone.
I wanted to talk about another new study out of the Imperial College in London that about the role of sperm as a factor in miscarriages. Carrying a fetus to term is commonly thought of, once again, as a female reproductive issue, but this study found that male sperm health can dictate the health of a pregnancy. What do you make of that?
Well, I did look at that study, and in reality, 60% of miscarriages are caused by a genetic problem, and that suggests that the male sperm is also partly responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the study also studied a number of men, particularly in cases where they had three or more consecutive miscarriages.
Mm.
And they noticed that there was very poor DNA quality in those men and DNA damage. And so it looks like, according to this study, sperm is a very, very important factor in miscarriages.
Not all sperm are created equal, in other words.
Absolutely not. And they proposed something that I thought very interesting. They think that the sperm damage is triggered by a reactive oxygen species. They call it ROS, which is found in a fluid, the seminal fluid that bathes the sperm.
Uh-huh.
And the abnormality in this causes, this has a protective factor for the DNA, and when they see this deficient, there is increased damage to the DNA. So they're working right on the molecular level, and I think they're really onto something. I think this is an interesting study.
Okay, well, we will follow up on that and other men's sexual health news with Dr. Dudley Danoff in the future. And thanks again for your time today.
Always a pleasure.
Dr. Dudley Danoff, Los Angeles-based urologist and author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you so much for your attention. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.